Welcome to Embrace the Green Photography Podcast, a podcast focused on all forms of photography and the people who love to create. If you love cameras, analog or digital, old or new, expensive or economical, we welcome you here with open arms. Okay, welcome to episode 89. And this one must be the all-time worst technical difficulties, just even logging on air tonight.
It was a struggle, wasn't it?
Oh, man. So I'm using a totally web-based version instead of the usual app that I use. And that's because the app is completely black.
Yeah, that's not great for it.
No, it's hard to see what you're doing when you can't see the buttons. Anyway, tonight we are joined by, with a guest, Johnny Martyr. Did I say your last name correctly?
Yeah. Hey, thank you. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah. So we also have Jake and Larry and myself, Sherry. Haha, that rhymes. Anyway, so we managed all to get on here, and our first show back from the hiatus with a guest.
Woohoo.
Yeah, we're out of practice, too. So, Johnny, can you tell us why did you first get into photography? What was it that drew you into the craft and decided, hey, this is something that I really want to pursue? We lost Johnny?
Oh, no.
Maybe we lost Johnny.
He's muted. Johnny, he's are muted. You muted?
Now he's can you guys hear me now?
Oh, he can hear you now. Did you hear the question?
I did hear the question. Oh, my gosh. Tonight has been fraught with technical disaster.
It's one of those nights.
I thought, oh, no, it went down again.
Another new film.
All right. So, yeah, can you tell us what drew you to photography?
I guess it's kind of a complicated path. Nothing straightforward about it. Like you asked, what made me want to pursue it? I feel in some ways, maybe it's a cliche response, but it's I guess maybe photography has pursued me. It's this thing that I seem to not be able to stop doing. In fact, there was a period of several years during which my wife and I kept talking about stopping our photography business, and we kept talking about it, and then we'd get an offer for a cool gig and we'd do it, and we'd talk about stopping and we get another offer for a cool gig. And it just seems like once you're out there and doing it, it kind of pulls you along by the current, regardless of if you want to be doing it at that particular moment or not. So, I mean, I guess that in terms of, to answer your part of the question about pursuing it, I think that's a little bit of my answer for that. As far as like what started it, I'm terrible at painting and drawing. And so the camera does that a lot better than I do. And I also am a bit of an introvert, so it's nice to have something to hide behind at parties.
Yeah, there you go. I feel you there.
I think we have a lot in common.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Are you also someone that doesn't like to be in front of the camera, Johnny?
Oh, yeah, I can't stand it. Actually, and Jake, I've talked to you about this. I think a few years back, you'd asked me if I wanted to be on here. And I was, a few folks asked me about doing podcasts, and I kept refusing because I just really nervous and shy about the entire thing. But Billy Sanford from Sunny 16 reached out to me few months ago, did a podcast with him, my sort of inaugural podcast, and he kind of he was great and kind of broke me, I think, of my fear of that. And also, I was just like, I got to get over myself.
Yeah, it's just a conversation at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Just talking about cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about photography.
Which we do all the time anyway, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Might as well hit record while we're doing it.
Yeah, I had to laugh. My husband, he found out that I have this podcast that I'm on. And so he turned it on and he listened to it for about 5 minutes. He goes, yeah, I couldn't understand anything you guys were saying. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, I guess if you're not in the world, it definitely wouldn't mean much to you.
No, but it does give me a place where I can talk about it with someone else who's into it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's nice to actually be able to discuss the thoughts rather than just going back and forth via messenger.
Yeah. So, Johnny, what is it that keeps you creative?
I don't think that I am creative. I do documentary photography. I'm really terrible at coming up with ideas. I don't like to do pose photos or anything like that. I don't think I am creative. I think that I like to find, artistic ways to render what I see. And I'm not sure if I have a good eye or life around me is, I just view it in a positive light, so to speak, or what. But I don't think I'm creative actually at all. So I don't know. Does that kind of make sense at all? I'm not.
It does. It does. Well, totally.
I hate to disagree with the guest, but looking at the people tab of your page, I think that you are. I notice is that your event or like these wedding photos and the band photos and the straight up photojournalism, oddly enough, all work together. Do you come to them from the same place?
Thanks. That's a cool question. I often have trouble sort of reconciling my different subject matters, but I do approach them kind of all the same way. I was talking with Jake about this. I recently photographed the comedian Nikki Glaser, and I have never photographed comedy before. I've only even been to a handful of comedy shows. I listen to stand up and watch stand up on TV, but I had never photographed it before. But it's really no different than photographing a speech at a wedding, but for 2 hours. Right. Instead of 10 minutes. Although some of the wedding speeches do go on for 2 hours, it feels
like. But they're usually drunk then, so they're usually more entertaining.
yeah, they can be. Kind of the premise is the same, and I think it's kind of funny. I have a lot of trouble. I recently asked folks that follow me on my Facebook group, my Facebook page, it's like, because I'm kind of trying to build a new website and redefine things a little bit. And I asked, am I photojournalism? Am I documentary? Am I lifestyle? What am I? What do you guys think I am? Because I don't really know. Like, sort of the splitting hairs between genres. And I mean, documentary is obviously different than editorial, but I think. It gets to a point where my whole thing is that I'm pointing my camera at events and people, sometimes objects, and I'm not lighting them. I'm finding natural light. I'm finding moments that work for me, what I'm trying to say with them, and all that's kind of the same. So I think, if you're shooting a concert, back to your question, if you're shooting a concert, you're shooting a wedding, you're shooting a comedy show, you're shooting your kids running around the house playing with the dog, whatever it is, I think all these things kind of come from the same place, and certainly my approach to them is similar. Of course, each one's got its own nuances, but it kind of drives me crazy when people break everything up into all these little, like, street photography or photojournalism or, you know, whatever. Like, I think for me, at least, I guess I paint with a wide brush, but I think they're all kind of intertwined.
Well, if you're going to force me to choose one, it feels to me like you bring a photojournalism eye to all of your photography. I approve of that because I was once a photojournalist, so way to go.
That's awesome. Yeah, thanks. That's what I'd like to lean towards. I think it just sounds a little bit more romantic, and I think people know what it is. The consensus on my post was actually documentary. So I've been kind of like, you know, trying to gear up in that direction. But I do identify a lot with the sort of classic mid-century photojournalism, sort of the black and white, like life photos, you know, James Dean photos, you know, that's kind of early, you know, the Leica M days, the sort of golden years of photojournalism. I really love all that stuff. So,
yeah, awesome. I was wondering, I'm not really sure exactly when you got started doing photography professionally, but was film photography like something you did professionally like from the beginning, or is it something you worked in over time? And I guess if it's something you gradually introduced, I was curious, how did clients receive that in the beginning? Was that something they were interested in, or...
Yeah, thanks. I get that. I get sort of this line of curiosity pretty frequently, I think, because I think people are you know, it's kind of this different thing to shoot film in professional environments in 2023. And so I think are always and I think a lot more people want to be doing it. I'm always running into other photographers. When I was with the Nikki Glaser tour, I talked to a lot of her other photographers because, like I said, I had no experience with it before. So I talked to a lot of other guys to try to like figure out what the hell I was doing. And, you know, they were a couple of them were like, oh, wow, you shoot like only film, like you're not going to bring a digital camera with you, like you're only going to shoot film, like. And I was like, yeah. And they were like, I wish I could do that. But, you know, and people have these lists of reasons why they don't. For me, it's been kind of the reverse. I started shooting, I guess, probably in like late high school. I went on a class field trip, and the girl that I was dating at the time had a K1000 and you know, she was shooting like probably, you know, like 400 speed film or something. So we were in these dark museums, and she was like, you know, dragging the shutter and holding her breath and taking shots like that. And I was like, that's really neat, you know, like that she kind of has to get in tune with like the device to like get the photo. And I just thought that was really neat at first. That got me interested in photography. And then I guess because and this was the late 90s, so film was still just the way that we did things. And when I went to college, I got started with a wedding photography business. And at that point, digital was still pretty fresh. And so we were shooting all the candids on digital, like Fuji SLRs with Nikon lenses, because I think Nikon still didn't actually have like a sort of a viable DSLR at the time.
Right.
And then we were shooting all the formal stuff on like Hasselblads. So, okay. So I was Brad Zizzo. I was his B shooter, and I was like keeping his Hasselblad backs loaded and, you know, learning both film and digital together on a professional level at that point. And my dad was kind of a gearhead too when I was in high school. So he had like one of these early like Casio digital cameras with like the floppy disk you had to record to.
Right. Yeah.
I think it took like, you know, 2 megapixel images or something. So, you know, I was always around digital actually, you know, as far as being into photography. So they were kind of concurrent for me for a while, but I think doing the weddings professionally with Brad, and I just identified more with film, and I didn't understand why everybody was geeking out over digital. Yeah, so it was like,
fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, I'm you know, you guys, I didn't have to explain it, but a lot of people I do. But yeah, I just, I guess I just was all, for a while there, there was a period where I was shooting a hybrid of film and digital together. I was working at a magazine, and so I would shoot digital to get them the stuff that they needed the next day or the day of. Excuse me. But I was shooting film on the side, you know, and using those as my, like, as my personal shots. So I photographed Bill Clinton once, and during a rally, you know, I got the magazine, the digital shots of him, and then I had my film shots for, like, my personal stuff. And I was like, I need to flip this. I need to be shooting the film as my thing, because that's what I care about. And I never understand why, I guess, people don't shoot the way that they want to shoot, or shoot what they're passionate about as their front-facing thing. So that's kind of, in short, I hope that answers the question.
No, it totally does. Do you think it's, I guess, the inconvenience, quote unquote, of film that draws a lot of people away? I'm far from a professional, so I really don't have an insight into it. But from an outsider's perspective, that's what it seems like to me, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of guys, other professional photographers, and they tell me, they always blame it on the client.
On the client, yeah.
They always say the client wants the photos yesterday. I hear that so often, and I'm like, but where did they get that expectation from? You know, we're the photographers, like, we should be, like, steering the boat, right? I mean, to some degree, I mean, I obviously understand it's a struggle to try to do journalism, for example, on film. I've been to news events, shooting film, had to get back home, process, turn around, get the photos out within, like, you know, less than 24 hours, less than 12 hours. That's a real hustle.
Been there, buddy.
Yeah. You know,
that's real.
And I love that, but I can understand why that is, like, not favorable to people too. So you have to really, like, dig into it. You have to be really super passionate to be able to do that kind of thing. Luckily, like, I found some genres of business. Wedding photography is great for film, because there's no, like, you know, clients want photos the day after as, like, a preview, but you can have like a couple of weeks or even a month to, like, finalize all their images most of the time. So
when you shoot a wedding, is someone else shooting color?
So my wife and I work very closely together. And I think, you know, I'd be remiss to not to owe her some gratitude, I guess, for my ability to keep shooting black and white film. she shoots digital, she shoots color, and we do a lot of work together. So I think a lot of our clients will hire us for her and then get me and hopefully be, you know, happily surprised with the results and, you know, expand their horizon a little bit. And then a lot of folks hire us, you know, for my stuff, and then they get her stuff too, and they love it. So it's kind of nice having that workflow, because it allows me to not be a hybrid shooter, but still be in a position to offer people, you know, both products. Yep. Of course, we do work separately too, but the stuff that we do together, I think, is really good for our clients. So
awesome.
I guess I have one more question, unless you wanted to go to break, Sherry.
No, go for it.
Okay, I guess, while we're still talking about you shooting here, Johnny, how did you eventually land on Leica as your kind of go-to brand? I know you shoot some other stuff as well, but when I think of you and your photography, I think of you shooting your Bernac Leica and your M6.
Yeah, I you know, it's funny. I bought my first M6 probably like 12, 13 years ago. And it's maybe a little longer, maybe even 15 years ago. It was, but the climate for the M6 was vastly different than it is now. I could never have predicted that it would be a popular camera because in the Leica groups at the time, people really kind of poo-pooed that camera because it's not made of brass and not made in Wetzlar and just these silly things that you know collectors care about, but photographers don't. Right. So I've been shooting that camera along with my Nikons, and then I moved into, like you said, my 1930 Barnack. I have a few LTM Leicas, but the 1930, I don't know, for some reason I just clicked with that camera, and I do use that for some paid work too. But I've been using these cameras for a while alongside with Nikon and occasionally some other brands and formats of camera, but I don't know. When I post on social media, people just really kind of gravitated a lot towards the Leica stuff. I don't know if it was the word Leica or they actually like the images better or what, but somehow in the last, I want to say like 5 years or something, I've become pretty associated with Leica. They have not called me for a sponsorship yet.
But still waiting on that one.
It's probably because I'm still using Voigtlander lenses sometimes. But
they don't need to know that.
They don't need to. They're very patronizing when I go to the Leica stores with my Voigtlander lenses on. I'm not sure. I do love Leica, and I guess I think there's a lot to talk about with Leica. But I love my Nikons too. I have a fleet of Nikons that are, you know, my SLR system for paid work, and my Leicas are my rangefinders. Of course, there just isn't anything else like a rangefinder, I guess, is the whole thing. So I was using a Voigtlander Bessar II for a while, but it just really just can't stand up to the work that I do. It's not a professional body. I moved into Leica because I needed a tough camera that I enjoyed using. It's really important to me to use a camera that motivates me and motivates me to take my best photos. I also think if you use higher end cameras and higher end lenses, well regarded cameras and lenses, then you can never have the excuse like, oh, I sucked at this shoot. I failed at this shoot because I have shitty equipment or something. You know, that excuse is off the table. Like, you have the best equipment, so you should be doing a great job.
Yeah, that's a great point. Nothing to hide behind.
You know, I feel like your photos are more, you know, you can buy a handcrafted chair or you can buy something at IKEA. Mm-hmm. I feel like your photographs with the, you know, with the film and the classic rangefinder and the look are more of a handcrafted piece rather than a utilitarian something to put your butt on.
Yeah. I one of the things I sort of struggle with is I see these amazing you know, black and white photos that are like just beautiful compositions, beautiful images. And I think that some of my work is a little pedestrian sometimes, you know, especially some of my wedding photos. It's, you know, it's literally people just smiling at a camera. And, you know, maybe that is a little simplistic. But I think that by doing things by hand, I think manually focusing, manually exposing, you know, having the film grain, manually processing the film. I mean, I don't print my stuff in a darkroom. I do edit digitally, but currently anyway, maybe that'll change. I think all those little touches, I think, turn something that that otherwise would be maybe be a simple enough cell phone photo into something a little bit more. I hope that translates.
But look, like, you know, this is that picture of the mother with the bride crying, you know, she's not quite crying, wiping her eyes. There's the bride with her getting her veil done. That's just you just push the button at the right time. Now, you could have used a you know, a digital camera and pushed the button a second earlier and hold it a second later and had 3,000 images to choose from and picked up the right one. But, you know, I think that there's, well, I mean, you know, I think there's something to be said about having that, having the craftiness to push the button at exactly the right instant. And it seems like you have that.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the things that I think the film photographers and the film community is maybe sometimes criticized for, because I see these people say things like, you know, you could have just taken that on a digital camera, you know. But I think, you know, from our perspective, yeah, like I could have got that moment by taking 15 frames of it and then selecting the best one. You know, but from our perspective, I think like we're probably, as a film photographer, you're going to be more proud of like getting that moment and getting it, like nailing all those things that you, you know, in my case, I'm not using any automation. So, you know, I'm getting the shutter speed right. I'm getting the aperture right. I'm getting all these things right. And there's so much to be proud of. And then the people ask, well, what does the client care about that? Like the client cares about, people are always saying the end product, right? But I think all those little decisions translate to the end product, or they do for me, because I think, you know, your reaction to the moment, you're not just recording the people that are in front of the camera. When you're doing everything manually, and even with like the processing, you know, you're recording the photographer's reaction to that moment, and everything that the photographer does to finalize that image is baked into that image. And I'm not saying that, you know, I can look at someone's photograph and necessarily pick all these things out, but I think that they contribute a sense that some people can see and value. So
not that there's anything wrong with shooting digital. I shoot it when I'm, you know, when I need to, when I'm shooting for the web, and when I'm, you know, when I have to post photos the next day, I do. But there's an authenticity, I think, is what you're, is that, that you see, that is, there's a difference between picking out the best of 30 and having the best one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's an authenticity that you, so like music, you know, an acoustic, you know, you hear an acoustic band at a bar, and it's maybe not technically perfect, but it's real and happened in front of you, and you can feel that. I don't want to get so, and I'm getting kind of weird here, but
no, you know. I think that's a great analogy. It reminds me of a I forgot if it was a documentary about them or what, but I guess I was watching this video, and this guy was talking about how he recorded Debbie Harry and Blondie, and how like they couldn't really, they weren't great precision musicians. Right.
Exactly.
And he was playing back like the multi-track of like some of their hits, and pointing out how like the beat's wrong here, the beat changes here, like, you know, the whatever is incorrect. And I think that's the stuff that makes it like human, though, you know, and especially like sure. Today in like, you know, world of I think, you know, photographers have been asking for the camera to do all the work, I think, sort of for a really long time. And now they, I think with AI, they've kind of gotten their wish fulfilled to some degree. It's like you can have photographerless photography. I think there's room more now than ever, probably, for an appreciation for handcrafted, like you said, the stool from IKEA, or the stool from that was, you know, built by an artisan. I think, you know, there's a time and a place, just like you say. I hate to make it a digital versus film thing too, because digital is great. For me, it's more of a automation against manual, like, I guess, thing. And it's, you know, it's, there's a time and a place for each. And I don't like the narrative of a world where there's no time for doing things oneself. So.
Besides, who wants six fingers in a perfect complexion?
Well, six fingers might be kind of cool.
I don't know. I always laugh at those.
Well, sometimes with the TLR, you could reach around and cock the shutter as you, easier if you had another finger.
You know, that's funny. I was kind of, my thoughts were going there too. I recently was telling Jake about this Weltar folding rangefinder, medium format 6x6 rangefinder that I just picked up, and it's it was made in the 30s, so it's the shutter release is on the left side, and the viewfinder eyepiece is on the right side, and you almost need a sixth finger to use this thing. It's been blowing my mind trying to use this, because it's literally the opposite of everything that I'm used to with shooting a Leica, for example. So it's kind of neat, I think, to challenge yourself and challenge your conventions every once in a while. Switch things up.
Absolutely, yeah, especially when it's a fun old camera like that.
But I take your point, Sherry. I don't think any bride's ever going to go to chat AI and say, make me a wedding photo.
Yeah. No, definitely not.
She might say, make my wedding photo, make me a little skinnier in my wedding photo, but she won't say, make me a wedding photo.
Yeah, I think, it's an interesting time for, I mean, we've seen these contests for journalism that have, people have entered AI altered images in them, and then they've won, and then there's been a, press release about it, and how, the controversy of that, and like the meaning of it. And I think people do really care about capturing genuine moments, digital photographers, people using auto this and auto that, even they are like, this is going too far. So, yeah. I think it's cool. I think this is a good time for what all of us are doing. I think that,
yeah,
I don't know, hopefully it's going to continue to be valued. There seems to be like a bit of a renaissance in film photography going on right now. Hopefully we'll continue to see more of that.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. So maybe we should take a little break here and see if it's actually recording.
Yeah, good idea.
All right, we'll be right back.
How old does a camera have to be vintage? Is 20 years old enough? For the Sony DSC F828, I think it's plenty old enough. First, this camera looks like nothing built today. To be fair, it looks like nothing that was being built back in 2003 either. Except for its Sony F model stablemates, the 505 and the 707, there was no 606, maybe because that number was used by a line of Walkman cassette players. Anyway, the F505 and F707 and F828 each appears to be the result of the unholy union of a turn-of-the-century Digicam and a Sony Handycam camcorder. While the silver 505 and 707 are pretty clunky, the black 828 is, well, sexy. As the last of the line, it finally grew into its symmetrical utilitarian design. It reminds me of a Star Wars pod racer. The Sony's unusual design really works ergonomically. If you grew up using SLRs, your hands will fall right into place. Your right grabs the hefty grip on the Digicam-like body, with your forefinger falling right on the shutter release. Your thumb lands on the stubby menu joystick just below the PSAM dial. Your left hand naturally cradles the Handycam-like lens barrel, with an honest-to-goodness zoom ring between your thumb and forefinger. That's right, you don't zoom by wire, like most Digicams. The mechanical zoom ring is faster and feels more precise, even after 20 years. Let's take a minute to talk about that big, beautiful lens on the F828. It's a Carl Zeiss Vario sonar, for what that's worth. Obviously, the lens is permanently mounted, but if you can only have one lens, this is the one to have. First, it's plenty sharp for the 8-megapixel sensor. Plus, the zoom range goes from an equivalent of 28 millimeters to 200 millimeters. At the wide end, the maximum aperture is a very respectable F2, but zoom it out to 200 and it only drops a single stop. Even with the teeny 2/3-inch sensor, you get some nice bokeh at f2.8 and 200 millimeters. Speaking of the sensor, it's a CCD, so the skinny-jeaned hipsters and YouTube influencer crowd will love it. But it's not your average CCD. Instead of reading just three colors, red, green, and blue, the 828 reads a fourth, emerald, which I think is cyan. Whatever magic the Sony engineers baked into that little chip really does work. The colors are great, especially the reds. And don't hate me for saying this, but it looks a little bit like Ektar. The Sony F828 does have a superpower. It can see in the dark. This is one of the last cameras equipped with Sony's night shot system. In near total darkness, a press of a button swings the infrared filter away from the sensor, allowing night vision green photography. But if that's not your cup of tea, the feature can be hacked with a magnet and a filter to produce full spectrum IR photos in daylight. I haven't tried this myself, but there are some YouTubers who will show you how to do it. I found my F828 at a local thrift store, slumming it with some trashed VHS and 8mm camcorders. For $29, I took a chance. Heck, the 1GB compact flash card was almost worth that. Luckily, it takes the same charger another of my Sony cameras uses, and the battery held a charge. For digital technology, two decades out of date, the 828 takes very nice photos. The shutter lag that plagues so many digital cameras of this age is not too bad. The EVF and rear screen are good enough. 8 megapixels are plenty for social media. I even had a picture of my dog printed at 5x7 at the drugstore, and it looks as good as those from any other camera. And the colors are amazing. So should everyone listening rush out and buy one? Well, sure, if you can find it for $30. However, the word is out about the IR hack, so the eBay sellers are asking more than $150 right now. The 828 was Sony's higher-end prosumer still camera in 2003. I know this one was used at least semi-professionally because the images I found on the card seemed to be for a jewelry store's ad or website. It was priced similarly to some APS-C DSLRs back in the day. Soon after the 828 was released, though, Sony bought Minolta's A-mount DSLR technology, making these high-end digicams redundant. But what if, in an alternate universe, Sony never bought Minolta and never sold an Alpha, and kept on leveraging their video camera technology to improve their still cameras? Maybe we would have a whole nother type of professional camera to choose from today. Or maybe not.
And we are back. Johnny, you mentioned that you love your Nikons as well as your Leicas. Can you tell us a little bit about your Nikon gear?
Yeah. I'm pretty select, I guess, about which Nikon bodies I use. I've been using Nikon, since the early 2000s. I got my first. I think I got an FM was my first Nikon, and I just loved the lenses that were available for that. And I owe much of my education as to what lenses go on what bodies to Ken Rockwell, as I'm sure many do.
His growing family?
I did not feed his growing family. I'm waiting for him to feed mine first. hopefully he knows how much he means to me, his words. I was a Pentax guy for SLRs for a while throughout school. I mentioned that the girl that I was dating in high school had a K1000, so I just bought a K1000 because she had one, and it seemed cool, and I really loved that camera. I love Pentax, but the Nikon was it just felt like a step up for me in terms of just all the lenses that were available. It just seemed like any particular length or particular speed lens or almost any price lens, it seems like you can get it for Nikon. And I thought that was really cool in the beginning. I've shot on a lot of Nikons, but I kind of narrowed it down. I have a couple FM2Ns and F2SBs that I use for all my paid stuff. Kind of like the FM10, which is like kind of a silly camera, but I kind of like that people hate it. And so I still use it because it works great for me. I also am a Micromat fan, so I've got a small fleet of Micromats that I use particularly when the weather's bad. I don't want to really bring the Leica M6s out in snow and rain, so I go to Micromat a lot for that. They seem to handle the bad weather, and I haven't had any problems with them, but if I did, they're like $50 in most cases, so not too big, not a big loss there. But Yeah, so I like Nikon in that regard. I love how small and compact and well featured the FM2N is. It's hard for me to decide really between the FM2N and the F2SB. I like the F2SB because it kind of feels like a Nikromat. It's got a lot of the sort of the build quality of the Nikromat, but the features of the FM2. So
Bodecker vibes.
Yeah. It's like sleek versus Bodecker.
Exactly.
But if I'm shooting alongside my Leicas, I often will bring the FM2Ns because they just pair together. It's a little bit more compact, so it fits in the bag together. Whereas when I start bringing the F2 and the long lenses, it's like it's got its own bag. But the F2 or the Nikons, I should say, really save my ass every once in a while. Like when I was shooting Nikki Glaser for her comedy stand up, I was using all Leicas backstage and for the close up stuff. And I'm no stranger to using telephotos on Leicas, but I needed more reach than I could get with a Leica. You know, Leica M's only go to a 135 with the built-in frame lines. So I needed more reach. I used a Nikkor 1828 to photograph her stand-up, and that turned out to be the perfect lens. I also have like some even longer ones than that, but that was the perfect length for what I was doing there. And I love rangefinders, but I think you know, there's just some stuff that, you know, needs to be done with an SLR. I sort of joke every once in a while. I like to take photos of my cameras with my FM2 and the Micro 55 2.8 Micro, which is a fantastic lens. It's like. It's one of the sharpest lenses I own, I've ever used, really. And you can use it as a normal lens or you can use it as a macro lens. It's great. It's funny because I'll post a photo of a Leica, but I took it with my Nikon, you know. it's sort of revealing, I guess.
Yeah, I guess macro is one thing you can't really do with rangefinders. I know there's like there's close up rings and stuff like that, but
yeah, there's rigs for it, but it's definitely not as intuitive as you can get with a SLR. So
no, that's true.
But I'm also, you know, I'm not one of those guys, like, there's a lot of Leica folks that don't use long lenses. I don't understand that either. They didn't use 90s or 135s. you know, and I think that's kind of silly, too, to buy, like, such a nice, expensive camera and to not use those. I mean, if you don't need those lengths, then that's fine. But, right. You know, to be against using them or to switch over to an SLR, you know, just because you want to move to like your 85 seems sort of silly to me. I think they just do things differently. And I think if you use a rangefinder like a rangefinder instead of trying to use it like an SLR, then, you know, a lot can be learned there. So,
right.
Well, that's a good point.
Well, this podcast is Embrace the Grain. So what I see that some of your photos do embrace the grain. What sort of film stock do you use?
Yeah, I almost want to say it's controversial sometimes how grainy some of my photos are. You know, I get people that really don't like what I'm doing or don't understand what I'm doing because it's so grainy. I really love, actually, I'll just say this. Like, I think I really came into my own as a photographer, and I certainly came into my own as a professional film photographer, when I started using Kodak T-Max P3200 and Ilford Delta 3200 and learning how to use those high-speed films in available light. On a practical level, using those two stocks is, you know, it's like a Swiss Army knife. You can do anything if you use those films correctly. You can shoot in almost in any, well, I wouldn't say any lighting conditions. There's definitely some amazing low light performance coming out of like Sony Alphas and stuff now, but that I wouldn't really even attempt with film. But as far as the, you know, pushing the boundaries of how dark it can be to get a good picture on film, those two stocks are really where it's at. And I think that's really exciting. And you can shoot them in the daytime too, which is really cool. I embrace the green for sure. I think that, you know, there are, I think that heavy film grain really catches people's attention, and it makes them start questioning the conventions of photography, right? So I think, you know, like there are some closed-minded folks who look at that stuff and they're like, oh my God, you know, like it looks, this person looks like they have measles, I've heard, you know. what's that?
I said, oh geez. Yeah. I've never heard people say that about grain.
Yeah. I mean, I get, well, you know, I think, when you show your work in like the film community, people, you know, are a little bit more accepting of these kind of attributes, but as you show it like outside of the film community, you know, I write for Petapixel pretty frequently, and you know that crowd's really fucking tough. Sorry, but that's like, yeah, that is a tough crowd, and like those people, they're really critical. And I think grain is one of those things where some people just really hate it. And for a century of photography, photographers were working against, you know, they were working towards making finer and finer grain images. You know, up until digital made it easier to get sort of noise-free images at high ISOs. So I think a lot of people, like, you know, the big grain, it really forces people to, if they're willing to consider these conventions and to think about why everything's normally very smooth and glassy and clean and sterile, you know? Yeah, and I think that, I mean, without even going into all the reasons why I enjoy it, I think just opening people up to that question, I think is really important.
So that's what you're saying is you go with the grain by going against the grain.
I like that. I'm going to have to use that.
So have you ever used the 3200 speed films at 1600?
I'm not really sure why I know when this became popular. I actually think I know who started this thing, but it's really popular, I think, for people to advise folks using these films for the first time to shoot them at what people seem to refer to as their native ISO. Depending upon whose opinion you're reading about this, I think they vary. I think Ilford is supposed to be 1000 and the Kodak is supposed to be 1600, maybe 1200, something like that. But yeah, I really advocate for pushing these films to their limits, you know, or for what you need. But I maybe I shouldn't even phrase it like that. I should say that I advocate for using them appropriately for the lighting condition and the results that you're looking for. because yeah, I definitely have shot, I rate, both T-Max and Delta at 1600 or 6400 usually are my two extremes. I've rated them at other ISO or other EIs and developed them at different EIs as well. There's a lot you can do with them. But I think a lot of people are almost scared to shoot them. I think that what the common advice is that you shoot them at 1600 and just let your lab process them at box speed. And people say, you know, that really makes punchy contrast and that kind of thing. But I mean, what can you shoot at 1600 ISO? I mean, that's like the interior of a sort of a normally lit home, I think, is 1600. Like you can't shoot, you know, a bar at midnight at 1600 ISO, in my experience. so I think, I like to get a 6400. I almost use 6400 rate at 6400 and process at 6400 as like defaults. That's not to say though that you know, if I'm in a different quality light, maybe a flatter light, and I want some more contrast, and I have enough light, then I'll shoot it at 1600 and process for 3200 or 6400 and get that contrast and that punch that people talk about. But yeah, I think there's just a lot to do with these films, and I advocate for not boxing oneself in to any particular method with them.
Okay.
That's a good tip for sure.
So what is your process? Do you process or do you use a lab?
Yeah, I used to. So when I was starting, I went to film school, and so of course we learned, you know, we had like a very high end dark room, and you could do all kinds of things that I don't even remember how to do now, in this place. But when I was starting, I guess I thought that I needed a lab to do my work for me, and so I guess I was just between less dark rooms. Skills and experience, I guess, at the time, and thinking, oh, this is paid, so it needs to be perfect, and I can't produce perfect, so I use a lab. So my point is for a long time I used labs, but the labs in my area became unreliable and just were not able to, and particularly actually with the high speed film, like they couldn't really process and scan it correctly, or you know, maybe I shouldn't say correctly, but to the standards that I was looking for. So that was around the time, that was around 2012 when Kodak went bankrupt. I did an article about this, about a couple that I photographed that year that they went bankrupt, their wedding. And then we recently did their 10-year anniversary. And Steph and I photographed them again for that. And I was comparing the state of the film industry then to now. And that was a big difference, was that in 2011, I could take my stuff to a lab and get it back. And it was, you know, great. 2012, that Kodak bankruptcy seemed to have affected all of, at least the labs in my area. And they started cutting down labor costs, maybe cutting down expenses, and their quality just fell off. And so I started processing all my own stuff. So that's where I'm at now. And that's where I've been since then, really, is I shoot 100% black and white. I shoot I process everything in Kodak HD110B, dilution B. And I only use 4 film stocks, really, which are Kodak T-Max 100, Kodak Tri-X 400, and of course, what we mentioned, the P3200 Kodak and Delta 3200. I do that to keep things consistent and ritualistic, maybe. I have a real simple setup, but that's what I do.
Sometimes simple's better.
And it's a lot better when
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I said it's a lot better when the TAs are keeping the chemicals up in school.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, those were good times. Of course, I didn't really understand what was going on half the time, but in the background though, I was like, why are these guys always filling these jugs?
So, anything else you'd like to add? Where can people find you on social media, Johnny?
I'm pretty active on Facebook and Instagram. I have some presence elsewhere, but not much. I think a lot of people feel at odds with social media, but I really enjoy like meeting, you know, the folks like you guys and, you know, other people that share our interests and visions on Facebook and Instagram. They are not perfect ways to share photography or conversation, but I think we're all doing our best. So
great. Yeah, so if somebody wanted to have a look at your work so they could see what we're talking about, what is your Instagram and your Facebook?
I'm Johnny Martyr everywhere. If you're so inclined to look for my stuff, if you Google Johnny Martyr, you can pick your website of choice. Yeah, Johnny Martyr Facebook, Johnny Martyr, I think Johnny Martyr Photo is on Instagram, but I think I still come up under just Johnny Martyr. I love Flickr, actually. I was a big Flickr fan, but the crowds just aren't there anymore, so I go where the people are.
I would advise folks to go to Johnny's website. The pictures are beggar.
Yeah, we do have control on our own websites of how our photographs are displayed.
This is true. Anyway, so I think that will wrap it up for tonight, and we will see you again. Bye for now.
Thanks for joining us, Johnny.
Yes, great talking. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
So, we are recording.
Okay.
Hopefully it showed up for you guys.
Mm-hmm. No, it hasn't. But that's okay.
I consent to being recorded.
Okay. What episode are we? 89?
89.
Okay.
It's just we never seem to start on time.
No, well, we tried.
Maybe next time.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll show up for you eventually, Sherry.
Oh, drat these computers. They're so naughty and so complex.